You're listening to the International Women's Day Environment Matters special here on Radio Verulam 92.6 FM with me, Amanda Yorworth. Now, a great way to improve our understanding of the world we live in and how we can live in it more sustainably is to become a scientist. But according to the Women in Science and Engineering Campaign's 2014 analysis of UK labour market statistics, women make up just 12.8% of the STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, mathematics, workforce. Fortunately for us, Rothamsted Research employs many women in some exciting and unusual research. I caught up with Daria Doberman, who kindly spoke to me as she was off for a well-earned break. Now, she's a PhD student studying insects as food, not a conventional feminist issue. Daria, thank you for joining me. Why is eating insects important for women in particular?
Eating insects has a very long history. It's a fairly new concept that's coming to the forefront, I guess, in Europe and America and things like that. But it's actually been around for hundreds and hundreds of years in countries in, you know, Africa and Asia. And it's particularly relevant to women because historically in those countries, things like farmland and livestock is men's business. So they are the ones who work the land or who own the livestock. And so it hasn't left much opportunity for women. In some countries, women aren't even allowed to own land. It's always their husband's land or their father's land. So they kind of sought out insects as their own area because it was something that men were like, oh, no, I'm not going to go harvest insects. And so it was something where women could go and say, you know what, no, you know, we're going to go harvest these insects. People want them. They have a market value. If we harvest them and sell them, we're going to make our own income. And so that's really how it kind of became a women's domain and a way to get income in their household. And it's also something that children and elderly are very active in.
Yeah.
So it's really something that's great for the most vulnerable populations in
Daria,
these countries.
Are insects, are they a healthy food?
I think it's hard to say what is and isn't a healthy food. I personally don't like to label anything as terribly healthy or unhealthy because I think it's all about moderation of anything.
Yeah.
But if we're gonna be very strict and break it down to a very basic nutritional level, then yes, they are. They're high in quite a few essential micronutrients like iron and zinc. They're high in protein. They seem to have like a fairly good fat profile, so they don't have kind of the longer chain fatty acids that you want. So similar to what's in fish, not the same, but similar.
Yeah.
So really, they are quite healthy. They're kind of up there with, if you're looking at protein meat sources, they're up there with kind of like chicken and fish.
Right.
In a health.
Okay, so that sounds, as you say, health or not is about moderation, but it seems like they tick a lot of boxes there. And how about their impact on the environment? We hear a lot about the negative impacts of cows in particular on the environment. How does raising insects as a source of protein compare?
So insects is a really interesting question, and it's quite complex to answer that question because it depends what country you're considering it in. So if we're considering it in, say, Thailand, where there are massive cricket producers, they produce them the same way that we produce, you know, chickens here, then the impact's not that massive because they don't have to spend any energy on heating.
Yes, I suppose it's hot there anyway, isn't
it? Yeah, they keep them outside in sheds, and then they feed them vegetable scraps, and they feed them a bit of chicken feed, and it's not bad, the impact. But if you want to raise them here in the UK, it's not, you know, a nice 28 degrees generally.
No.
And so you have to heat buildings.
Right.
And that takes a lot of energy.
Right.
So then they start becoming less sustainable and a bit more damaging here from that perspective.
Okay. So actually thinking about this, it really does have more relevance, certainly in developing parts of the world where the temperature is warmer naturally and they don't have to worry about heating because, of course, insects are cold-blooded, so they don't produce their own heat, do they? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely more relevant. And it's also more culturally appropriate in those countries.
Yes. Yes, yes. I mean, I was going to ask you that. I mean, do you think that at any time, we're likely to be ordering a packet of salted locusts and a pint in a St. Albans pub. Do you think that is on the cards at all?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's impossible. I know there's a company in London that makes salt and vinegar crickets, and they're not bad. I've had them myself. They're quite nice.
Salt and vinegar crickets, yeah.
So I wouldn't say it's impossible. I think it could be possible. I don't think they'll ever be a mainstay in the diet here.
Yes.
But then again, 20 years ago, people thought sushi was the grossest thing in the world in Europe. And now Everybody is eating sushi all the time.
Absolutely. And as you've said, given the good health indicators with insects, then who knows? Who knows what will be the next health fad? So, Daria, just tell us which aspect of insects and food have you been studying in particular?
So I work in a couple different areas. All of my work is focused on looking at it from the perspective of being based in Africa or Asia. So we're looking at it from countries where it is warm, where we don't have to worry about temperature, and where we also don't have to worry about people thinking it's gross.
Yes.
So we work with groups who already love to eat insects, who want more of the insects.
Yeah.
So one of the main projects that we're doing is looking at how to breed some of the insects on bio waste, so breeding them on food waste and things like that. We then have another project that's looking at using insect in fish feed, so improving the quality of fish feed for small-scale farmers in Africa is a really big issue because they don't have the finances to buy high-quality fish feed, and so their fish suffer. They don't grow as well. They take longer to grow. So if you can add something to their food source that will make them grow bigger, faster, and healthier, people have more food and they have more money from selling the fish. So it's kind of a nice benefit for everyone.
Right.
And then the last project we're working on is we're working on figuring out how to breed edible caterpillars in Burkina Faso.
Right, okay.
That are wild harvested right now. So those are the main three areas we're working on.
Right, okay. You've got. I saw a lovely video that you'd made showing how the women in Burkina Faso particularly like these caterpillars. Mm. And as you said at the start of the interview, it's very much something that women do and can help them, not just nutritionally, but in a business sense as well. You're looking for funding for that. Is that correct?
We are. It's actually great timing. We've just launched. So we have. For that project, we have actually gotten some funding from the Barilla Center for Food and Nutrition. Barilla, as in the famous pasta company in Italy.
Oh, right, yes.
So they've backed us with some money for the project, but we're still looking for a bit more. And we've actually started a crowdfunding campaign.
Right.
There's a website specifically for funding scientific research. It's really cool. It's experiment.com.
Right.
And so if you go on there and if you Google caterpillars, our project will come up. we've just launched it. So, any support from anyone would be great for that.
Well, a great way of trying to do something to support, you know, a really practical project, you know, helping women who particularly need it, which is great. I'll make sure that those links go on our website. So just thinking about your motivation and your route into science. I mean, you came into science quite a roundabout way via psychology and sociology. Mm-hmm. What motivated you to move into this particular area of science?
I think it was a bit of a twofold motivation. So when I was younger, my dad's a soil scientist, or a tropical agronomist, if we're calling him. I always said soil scientist because I was convinced he just looked at dirt all day. So when I was a small kid, I always said, oh, no, I'm never going to be a scientist like my dad. No, it's so boring. And and I think I fought that for my whole life, and then eventually got to a point where I had to kind of grumblingly admit that, you know what, okay, maybe I am meant to be in science, because a lot of the work I realized was more than just looking at dirt.
Yes.
That he was doing a lot of things that were really big scale when it comes to our food systems and trying to make them better for everybody.
Yes.
So that was kind of the first motivation, that I started seeing that he was actually having a much bigger impact than just, you know, showing me clumps of dirt like he did when I was a kid. And then it was just a matter of I having been in psychology and sociology, I felt like the work I was doing didn't have that impact. It was work that was interesting, and it was work that was perhaps very important for a very small group of people, and some of it honestly wasn't even important. It's that kind of work that gets done and just sits in a cupboard for years and no one ever looks at it.
Right.
And I had to admit that to myself about the work I was doing, which is a bit hard.
Yes. I'm sure there's some great work done in those areas, but...
It holds true for every area, so it's not as specific to those areas.
Yes.
And the work I was doing, I felt like wasn't having that impact that I wanted it to.
Yeah.
And so that's what really motivated me to look for something, to look for an area where I could have more of this impact. And I spent some time in New York working with a professor there, doing some work on writing a report for maternal malnutrition.
Yes.
And that's really what got me started in looking at nutrition more.
Right.
Because I thought, you know what, this is an area that we can really do something. There's a lot of kind of on-the-ground, impactful work that can be done on smaller scales as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, all of the work I do is on fairly small scales. It's with one farmer. It's with two farmers.
Right.
But the hope being that it can then be passed on to other farmers.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting because currently girls are, and women are overrepresented in caring professions, presumably because they feel they want to help people. But from what you're saying, actually, science is a very good way of providing really good help.
I definitely say so. I think that was a big motivation as to why I was in psychology in the first place, is that I worked with kids. So I worked in developmental psychology. So I wanted to help. I wanted to do something. And I was particularly interested in, like, developmental disabilities. So it was definitely all about, you know, how to help, how to make things easier and better for someone.
Yeah.
So I think it's transferred very much in a similar way. I'm very much always thinking about, you know, I want to help these communities. And at times it weighs quite heavily because you're like, you know, if my project fails, this isn't just, it to me, it's just my PhD project.
Yeah.
But to the communities I work with,
yes,
this is their lives.
And as you say, you actually meet specific people. You know, the people whose lives are going to affect, you've actually seen them. I mean, I've spoken to young girls, you know, sort of deciding on a career, who they say that they like science, but like you, they can't foresee any career apart from sitting in a lab doing what they see as dull research. It sounds like this hasn't been your experience. Would you like to reassure them?
Well, I think everyone has to be honest, though. I think every job ever will have some moments that are going to be terribly dull. I think that's true for every job. There's always going to be something that's a bit dull. And occasionally I do have to spend a bit of time in the lab, and it is a bit dull. But that's usually because of the way I'm working.
Yeah.
It's usually not the case that it's for very long, and usually because I'm getting interesting results. So the lab work may be tedious and it may take time, but the end result, so I'm getting this interesting data out that is useful and that can really make an impact. So that's, I think, what I always focus on.
Yeah, indeed.
And I think that's what everyone else focuses on too in jobs that are perhaps a bit dull at times, is you focus on the end.
Yes.
And what you're really doing and why is it important.
Yeah.
So why am I, you know, in the lab for 2 hours today?
Yeah.
Well, it's because if I get these results, then I can help this community. And I think it's very much about, I think often there's, for me, I think for a while as a female in science, I was a bit scared, particularly because of right now, there's a lot of men who work in science.
Yep.
There's also a lot of older, well-established men who work in science, and they're intimidating at times, particularly for someone who doesn't come from a science background. So I come in, I think, with a lot less than perhaps someone who studied science, because I don't generally know what I'm talking about.
But it sounds like you've not been put off by that, and you found your own niche.
Yeah, and I think you have to really think that even though they are intimidating, all of the most of us, not all, but the majority of people I've met are helpful.
Yeah.
And they're very keen for you to succeed, regardless of if you're male, female, you know, anything in between.
So your experience has been a positive one that you'd recommend to other girls?
Definitely. And I think it's very much about, you know, if this is something you love, then you can make it what you want. So, I mean, I came into my PhD and it was meant to be a quite different project. And I got into it and I said, well, you know what, I'd really like to change it in this way.
Yeah.
And although at points there was a bit of resistance, because I went out and I said, you know, look, I found this opportunity already. Can I do it? Because I kind of did some of the work ahead. people that I was working with said, well, I guess you already did half the work. Okay, go ahead. So it's very much about, I think, being proactive for yourself.
Being proactive, which is something that is a lesson for a lot of careers. Daria, I'm going to have to stop you there. That is absolutely fascinating. I do hope that you'll join us sometime again in the future, because it sounds like your work is really interesting and going to reap some really fantastic results. Daria, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was great.
I was talking there to Daria Doberman, a scientist at Rothamsted Research in Harpenden. Now, all the information from what she was talking about and from today's show can be found at rvenvironmentmatters.wordpress.com or on the environment pages of the Radio Verulam website, where you can also download the podcast. Now, I think I've just got time to tell you about an up-and-coming Women's Environment Network Forum, Feminism and the Environment, in Conversation, an event on what's gender got to do with climate change. That's on Wednesday, the 22nd of March at 6:30 to 9:30 at the Amnesty International Human Rights Centre in London. And Juliet Davenport, the CEO of Good Energy, is the keynote speaker, and they've also got a great panel of other interesting speakers. And Women's Environment Network say that they're doing this event as part of the Break Free Coalition, that's breaking free from fossil fuels, and they're focusing on the impact of climate change on women and marginalised groups. As I say, I'll make sure the details for that go on rvenvironmentmatters.wordpress.com. Now, you can sign up to receive our weekly podcast on the exciting new Radio Verulam website. Very easy to do. And you might also like to know that you can now list your event, whether it's a forum like the Women's Environment Network or indeed anything else, on the new Radio Verulam website. Now, we always love to hear from you. You can tweet us at rv_environment. You can email us at environmentonrv@gmail.com. Coming up next, Tatiana. So stay tuned until the same time next week. Thank you for listening.